Hey everyone, welcome to the Film and 5D podcast, episode 5. We're up to 5 now.
Catching up to Star Wars.
Yes. Our viewership is still down a little bit, I'm going to be honest, but we are up to 40 subscribers. We doubled on iTunes. Just saying.
I like that.
But I'm gonna guess that nobody listens the whole thing, which is sad, because the best part's at the end. And probably only 10% of the people who are subscribed actually listen. So we need to be more engaging. I need to go out of my way to kind of sell pitch this a little bit more, so people just don't like watching on YouTube for an hour, and I don't blame them, but it's definitely, I think we talk about some good stuff or car topics. But anyways, brief rundown. We're gonna, for first segment, we're gonna talk about what came out this week. Everybody knows what came out this week. I've already seen it. You didn't see it, but we're gonna talk about it. And then we're gonna talk about some news and rumors. We got some new Sony Zeiss lenses that came out, or that are coming out in the summer. They're announced to come out. And we're gonna talk about what we're excited about for those. And then we're gonna talk about a new camera that's rumored. It's coming out, but it's rumored what it's actually gonna be. And based on the rumors, it's gonna be very competitive with the camera we talked about on a previous episode from a manufacturer that shall not be named.
Canon.
Thank you. And then I'm going to do a more hands-on tutorial like we did last week with a white balance. We did our white balance episode 3 of Film in 5D, like almost 4 years ago.
4 years. Almost. It's been 4 years.
Almost 4 years. It was July of 2011. So yeah, almost 4 years.
Wow.
So, but we're going to go more into depth. I've never done a white balance episode since then. I've learned so much more about like white balance theory and like why you do certain things and how you can do certain things versus just like, here's the settings and here's what you do. So yeah, we're going to talk about that. You're going to talk about
Spinel
glass.
Yes.
And then Colton always talks about the most interesting things, so that's
totally.
And then we're gonna play another game of Do You Even Film, Bro? Let's see how you do. So stay tuned for that. All right, so just right up into it. Avengers came out this weekend.
Avengers.
I saw it today. We're recording this on a Saturday. My Clip City. We won. Game 7 against the Spurs.
Dude, isn't it spoilers?
Biggest win of franchise history. Pacquiao lost, which yep. I think I could speak for the both of us. We are both happy for our own reasons for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, sure.
We don't need to talk about that. There's plenty of other. Everybody's been talking. People are sick of that. So about back to the Avengers. It's got a 75% Rotten Tomatoes right now, which is much less than I think the original one had. I think it's the original one was more like 90s. Let me see.
Yeah, yeah.
92%. So, I know you have your opinions on the first one and why. Do you want to see the second one in theaters?
I think I will. But
honestly? Do you want to, honestly?
Do I want to? Not really. I don't really have.
Okay, so you will because you'll go with people who want to go see it, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like you did with me on the Avengers, which I thought was good, and you still were sour grapes about it.
No, I will acknowledge it was good. Like, it was funny. It was good. Like, I don't know, storytelling. Like,
it was cool. Funny. It was like the first time like a movie had like witty dialogue that made all the characters like kind of fit together. And this one was, I would say this one was even more funny. But then at times it was like almost too much funny. And sequels are, you know, sequels. Like, they try to put the characters through something else, but they've already gone through the whole, oh, we're the Avengers, we don't like each other, we got to work together and stuff. And like, the second one isn't about that, it's about something different, but they still have challenges. So, but it's just a harder thing to work with every time you make another movie, another layer on it, because there's only so much you can do. And there's another freaking moth.
Oh.
We've killed two and there's another one. This is like becoming the storyline of Film and 5D podcast. Like, jeez.
Maybe it just keeps coming back to life.
Maybe. So, I mean, what do you think about this movie?
Well, I think one of the problems is I kind of hate freaking Iron Man.
You hate the actor, or you just hate the character Iron Man? I mean, the last two Iron Man movies were not good. And let me just get on a soapbox for a second.
Okay.
See if you... Do you remember who was in the first Iron Man who they replaced in the other two?
Oh, yeah, that
do you,
one dude.
Do you understand why I have an issue with this? Terrence Howard, an Academy Award-nominated actor... Got replaced by, you know, kind of a fan favorite, Don Cheadle, a little bit older, whatever. Why?
I thought he just didn't agree to work on the other movies.
No, he was pissed. Google this, right? Bring up your iPad. I'll do it so everybody can see. Why wasn't Terrence Howard on the other whatever? Go ahead and keep talking about whatever you think about this.
Well, I only saw the first Iron Man. I'm kind of interested in seeing the other ones, but I don't know. I just hate him as a superhero. I don't really hate the actor, but I don't know. People say the actor is pretty similar to the real Tony Stark. But yeah, he kind of kills it for me, the Avengers.
Yeah, we're looking right here to see why he wasn't. The real reason he didn't come back to Iron Man was because of the film star. Ooh, so he did choose not to be in it.
Oh.
So you're right. But it was because he didn't like Robert Downey Jr., which is kind of a common theme. People who work with him, he's like one of those actors that people hate to work with, like Bruce Willis kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, ironically enough, Terrence Howard has worked with Bruce Willis in Hearts War. Yeah, that movie.
Wait, people don't like working with Willis?
He's on the list of like top 10 actors people hate working with. Gwyneth Paltrow, who's in Iron Man, ironically enough, is like another one of those kind of bitchy actors, actresses. Mm. Anyways, so yeah, I saw it. I would say, you know, without spoiling anything, I mean, a lot of people know what happens in, you know, comic books and stuff, but it was good. The special effects were grand. I mean, there's a lot of special effects, but some of them were pretty fake, in my opinion, especially when they were trying to make the actors look like they were doing all this crazy stuff. It's like, obviously not even a stunt double at that point. It's just like, you know, but they're doing it because, you know, they're doing these long takes where the camera just spins around and shows everything that's going on. So it's cool, and it's understandable why they can't pull it off 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I noticed less of that in Avengers 1. The enemy is really good, though. Much better than Loki. I mean, everybody likes Tom Hiddleston, whatever his name is. You watch Thor and everything, right?
Yeah, so Thor's cool. I like
Thor. Yeah. I like those when they're on the planet, not on the Earth, because the Earth is blah, whatever. which on the second one, they were in space more, whatever.
Yeah.
But Tom Hiddleston, who played Loki, whatever his name is, Tom Hiddleston, whatever. Everybody likes him as an actor. I just didn't like him as like the main center villain, you know, leading the army and all this stuff and mind control and all that. Like, I think this enemy was much more. It was played by David Spader. Spader? Yeah. He was
David
on
Spade?
Spader. Whatever his name is. He was on The Office for a bit. He was good. Yeah. I like him. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on. Everybody go check out that movie. It's going to break all the records like we were talking about.
Man, that's whack. I don't like that.
What, that it's going to break all the records?
Yes, I cannot accept that truth.
All right, so what came out, or what's coming out? So we got two new lenses. Two new, what brand lenses?
Zeiss.
We talked about Zeiss on a previous podcast, how sexy it is and how it pops in 3D, blah, blah, blah. So now they're starting to fill in some of the gaps of the focal ranges. We don't really have a wide angle Zeiss, so they got a 25 millimeter now, which is the widest prime currently available. You know, they have a 35 and a 55, and now they have an 85, which when I had my Canon, I had my 85. It wasn't the best lens, but it was the one lens that if I was doing photography, like portraits of somebody, that's like one of the most beautiful. 85 and 135, I think, are the best focal lengths for just taking like a headshot of somebody. It just makes them look nice and like the flat, and like it just highlights for most people, gives them the best look. So that 85 is the lens I'll be getting. And there's a couple reasons why. The 85 has OSS. So it's a prime, which most primes do not have optical steady shot. And this one does. It's going to be the first Zeiss Sony FE lens with OSS, which is really cool. The 25 doesn't. You don't need it as much for wide angle, because wide angle, but when you're zoomed in, all the shakes matter. So having the 85 is going to be really nice. It's going to be a photography lens. I'm going to say that right now. It's got the same issues as some of these other ones, where it's fly-by-wire, where the focus is smooth, but it's electronic, so you can't be exact with it. And it goes at different speeds, you know, depending. So it's definitely a photography lens. It goes down to 1.8, which will match up nicely with my 55, since that's also 1.8. So overall, you know, I'm looking at this to be my next lens, the 85.
Well, you know, the most interesting thing I saw when I was looking at that was the OLED display.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. But how long is that going to last? And a lens is an investment. They're supposed to last 10 to 20 years. You buy a lens, you know you're going to have that thing for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of wondering how more traditional people are going to accept that feature, because to me, it seems like, why bother? Like,
well, it's going to be... It's to keep the size down on it, first of all. You don't have to have the ring in there that kind of tells you your different focal lengths or your focusing, because obviously the focal length doesn't change, but the focusing distance does. So it's kind of being a nice little... tells you like how many feet away somebody is or whatever. So that's good. But yeah, I think it does last a long time. And even when it doesn't, it's an OLED. So essentially OLED basically means that the black areas are just there's no lights behind it. Mm-hmm. So technically that can last forever. And now eventually the sides around it, like the illuminated around it, will dim over time, you know, cause it's an OLED. It might have to be replaced after 5-10 years. But the actual pixels for the, you know, how far away things are, that they'll always be black. Essentially, it's an OLED. So that's the kind of reason they did that.
Yeah.
Now, on screen right here, I have the 85, which is, I think the 85 is what most people are excited about. The 25 is cool, and we'll talk about it later, but there's already a 28 Sony that has the ultra-wide converters and stuff. So that's like a little bit more, and it's I think a third the price. We'll talk about that in a bit, but a lot of people are excited about the 85 for the reasons of the OSS and it being the first true photography lens for the E-mount native full frame and all that stuff. And they're comparing, there's some crazy comparisons going on. This is the Otis. This came out, this is Otis 1.4. So it's a little bit lower aperture overall that you can get with it. Look, first of all, look how much bigger this is. Remember, we're using this for photography. At least I am. Now, this is a 4,500 lens, I want to say.
Oh, I didn't even see that. So you're saying those two lenses are the same performance then?
It's basically negligible. Like the basic tests, and I don't really understand this test. Like until we see more specific, like, you know, what has chromatic aberration, barrel distortion, all that stuff, which aren't very common with 85s. That's why they're so good. Just right off the camera, they're usually pretty good. Mm-hmm. But for this, so the 85's, you know, 1,200. And the Otis is, I want to say, let me pull it up real quick, actually, just to make sure. But I think it's like somewhere around 5,000, 4,000 maybe. 4,500. So more than quadruple the price for a lens that on paper is performing just as well. Now, maybe the focusing ring isn't as much throw like we talked about last time. Maybe, you know, this glass is obviously much bigger because it has to be for the 1.4 aperture. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if I can get a lens for a fourth of price that people are saying on paper is performing just as well in terms of image quality, I could give a, you know what, about the rest of the ergonomic features of it for an extra $3,000. I mean, so that's one of the really cool things. When I saw this, I was like, okay, I'm getting this lens. Like, for sure. Like, this will fit really, it's nice and small for my camera body. Like, it's perfect.
Yeah, I didn't really like the design, though. It looks kind of weird to me.
It's because of the optical set. You know, they got to make it kind of a little bit bigger than it should really be in terms of the glass so that it moves around. It's optical steady shot, basically. Mm. And then, so for the 25, I saw this interesting thing. It's not related to the 25, but it's talking about the 28. And how for a $500 lens, comparing it to the 1600, 35, and the 800, 35 that I have, and then even the 1300, 25, which isn't on here, it's saying the 28 actually holds up pretty well. You know, it's not Zeiss, it's not going to have that 3D coating look and whatever. But honestly, the 25 is a little bit less appealing to me. First of all, it's more expensive of the two lenses. Comparing it to the 85, it's $100 more. It's f2, which is pretty, you know, wide open for a wide angle lens. I mean, it's not 1.8 like the other one, but you don't really shoot that wide open on such a wide angle lens because everything's got to be wide and in focus. But I don't know, it's just not as excited about that one. Did you look at that one at all?
Well, I mean, I looked at the basic article with both of them and the features and stuff. Like, to me, most of the features seemed like it was more for like a photo, like photography.
Yeah, The 25 is definitely can be used for video, I think. I haven't seen how big it is. I'll have to see it. You know, these lenses have just been announced, so we don't even know what they're going to look like up against a... we've seen sample images, but we don't know exactly what they're going to look like, you know, on the camera, how big they'll be and stuff like that. So it remains to be seen, but definitely 85 is in my on my wish list. So yeah, the only thing about these are fly-by-wire, so that's why I don't suggest them for video. But like, I have my one true video lens to rule them all. I don't, you know, if I need one close-up shot on a tripod without too much focus moving, I'll use one of these, the 85 or the 55 I have. But really, I'm using that lens for pretty much everything else. But the optical steady shot is really nice for, my 85 I had on my Canon was not optical steady shot. So this is going to be a nice improvement. All right, so moving on to the new rumored camera, which is the Sony A7 R2. You know anything about this?
A little bit, yeah. I don't think there's really any details yet.
So, okay, so on my screen right now, we're looking at this shot. And now, this is a shot that was done with, I believe, the 85 millimeter. So it's got that nice, like I said, it's a nice portrait lens with the nice bokeh in the background, all that stuff. All the stuff that's nice with an 85. But if you take a look, someone took the image that was released and put it into Photoshop and realized that it was actually 9,000 by 6,300, which is 56 megapixels. And that this is actually not even the width of a sensor, of a full-frame sensor. So this is actually cropped even further, so that they're guesstimating that the new A7R is going to be 59 megapixels. Now, we talked about those Canons that are, 51, 52. So this one's the A7R, the A7R was the 36 megapixel bit. It was the, you know, first mirrorless to have the nice big resolution for nice landscape and, you know, for portraits and all that stuff. This is the A7R II. It's jumping up to 59. That is insane for photography.
I was kind of confused when I was looking at this, because I think in a previous article, they were saying they're going to be releasing A7R II and a different, a new camera to directly compete with the 5DS. That's a 50-plus megapixel camera. And people are saying that it wouldn't make sense for the A7R II to even,
I think there's only one camera coming out. I think it is the A7R II, and that's the one that's going to be the high 59 megapixel. That would be my... It's all speculation right now, but from what I've heard, and everybody's been... This is the first kind of image we've had, and it came out this week on Sony Alpha Rumors. It's the first one we've seen, but, you know, I really think that this is the one camera they have in their pocketbook to, you know, kind of compete with Canon. And the nice thing about this is it's mirrorless. It's a much smaller camera, and guess what? It's probably going to be half the price. That's the main... I mean, we're looking at the 5DS... I think the higher end model was $3,800, and this one's probably going to, since the A7R II is, I think, $2,200, so I'm guessing this one will probably be coming around $2,400 maybe. So it's going to be a third, you know, two thirds the price, or one third, you know, whatever, two thirds the price. So that right there is already in, you know, the lenses are smaller and everything else. I think a lot of photographers are going to start looking at mirrorless more seriously. Now we'll have to see what the performance is in terms of, you know, sports. I'm gonna guess it's not gonna be a sports lens camera, specifically mainly because you can't take 59 megapixel images, you know, super fast. It just can't be done. This is a, you know, you're on a tripod taking a nice beautiful picture that you're gonna put into a painting or, you know, at a display at a museum or whatever, and you're taking your time and you're editing that thing in Photoshop for months. Like, this is your one beautiful shot. Like, that, this is the camera that you use for that.
Can you really spend that much time on one shot?
Well, the interesting thing is for me, so I have my A7S. If they come out with an A7S Mark II and it's substantially better and I can get away with having two 4K cameras for the, you know, for one, like let's say it's 4K internal, I'll go with that. If they don't, and my A7S kind of stands up and holds up and it's good enough to be video, used for video for the next 5 years for me, my second camera, my B camera, will be this high megapixel, because my A7S is only 12 megapixels. So it's not that great for landscapes. I mean, to be honest, it's okay for portraits. It's actually really nice for portraits, but that's about it. I mean, everything else, like landscapes, wide open shots, like I can't really do that. So this would be a nice B camera for me to use. So that's, you know, an interesting thing. All right, so moving on. let's do tutorial.
Tutorial, yay.
On white balance. You ready to learn some stuff?
Tits me goats.
All right. I have some questions. So here is a white balance card.
But it's gray.
One side's white. One side's white. And one side's gray with the target on it. Mm-hmm. Why is it gray? And why, when we take our white balance, our custom white balance, why do we use the gray side instead of the white side? Do you think?
Because the gray is the mid-ground between black and white.
Very good. Okay, so what does that mean? What does that mean? He just dropped his notes.
My paper, no.
He actually took notes this time, which is nice. All right, go ahead. Why is it gray? You just said it. What does that matter for film, for video?
Well, because it can understand like a good, well, I mean, it's taking like a baseline where.
What is it when you say it's between white and black? What does that specifically mean for video? Like, why would I need to know what gray is? There's one reason.
Because it's the same distance from white and black.
Exposure. If your gray is exposed properly right in the middle, if I put this in front of the camera and filled up the whole screen with all the lights and everything shining on it, mm-hmm. and all of the on the histogram or whatever, everything was right in the middle, 100%. Guess what? Everything's exposed. Your blacks are exposed just as much as your whites are exposed. So the reason you, instead of using just the white, you have one of these. You could just use white to get the white balance. And you could say, okay, this is white. Tell the camera this is white. It'll shift, you know, around the spectrum until this is white. And then there you go. But it doesn't tell you the exposure because the white, look, it's blown out. Like we're looking at the screen right now. It's blown out, right? This is not blown out. This we can get so that this gray specifically, and with things like the Shogun that we have, you can set the false color so that maybe everything else will be different colors on the false color, but this gray will be gray. And if this gray is gray, then that means it's an even exposure. Now, you might not want even exposure, but most people like to have that on DSLRs because it gives you the most room to go either way in post. So that's why you have a gray card, 17% gray card.
Wait, what's a 17%?
Is this 17% gray, which happens to be the middle. And I might be wrong about this, but I assume that it happens to be the middle, exact middle between white, pure white and pure black. Mm. Okay, so a couple more questions for you. Don't look at my screen.
Okay.
But so how do you think auto white balance works and why shouldn't you use it?
Well, I would guess auto white balance maybe tries to guess what the white and black should be based on what it's seeing, and you shouldn't use it because it might not always be correct.
Right. Why shouldn't you use it for video specifically?
It might change between
stuff. Which you never see in a film when you won't go. There's no, the white doesn't automatically start turning blue all of a sudden, or you know, whatever, or the rest of the colors around. So, yes, it essentially guesses. What's the reason that it would guess wrong? Because it's a computer. I mean, it's using a computer. It's really most auto white balances are pretty good on most new cameras these days. Why wouldn't you want to use it? What specifically does the computer not get that a human gets?
Like a different light source.
If you have multiple light sources, so if you have a blue light and a green light and an orange light, or you know, any mix of lights, which most people do that. Most people use like a, you know, an orange light mixed with a blue light, or a, you know, a green light thrown in there in the back or whatever, you know, depending on what the location is, it's going to have no idea. If you have a red light, you know, mixed in, like it's going to have no idea what, you know, what to put it at, and it's going to drastically put it one way, so everything's going to be super red or super green or super blue. Make sense?
Yeah.
So now before I ask you more questions, I want to pull up a graph here.
Do you know what I was just thinking?
What?
What if they had like a smart camera? It took the data of the lights. Like, I guess it would be kind of like too much work, but like it knew what lighting you were using. Like,
so they have what's called, nobody uses these anymore, but I remember when I was in film school, people use them all the time, a light meter, where basically I would go up to your face right now and I'd say, oh, okay, I need to set this to 3300. Okay, done. Based on just your skin tone and whatever, it would know like from the light source what it was. But now with, you know, with white balance cards and with, I mean, they've always had these, but with false color, with false color and stuff, like there's really no reason to, you know, and you get the histogram with the little, wish I had a picture of it, I forget what it's called, but the little thing where it has all the different colors on the outside, and then essentially you want to be right in the middle or some balance of the middle to be white is white. So looking at this right here, pull this away for you to see. So here we have white in the middle. So we have the magentas, the blues, the greens, and I don't know what A means. I mean, it's orange. It's warm, I guess. I don't know why it's labeled A.
Oh, man.
But so you have your hot to cold, and then you have what's called your fluorescence, your artificial lights, because they're not found in the environment. So your greens and your magentas. So if you're adding in fluorescent lights, you know, you might get a little bit more of a green cast, so you might have to compensate by going up on the spectrum, etc. So light is measured in kelvins. Do you know what kelvins are? And like what different, you know, values they hold?
I want to say what? I don't know, like the warmth or heat.
Yeah. The warmth of the light.
Okay.
So what would you say is the warmest light?
Sun? It's pretty
technically
hot.
But no.
I don't know. Like one of those regular light bulbs.
So the shade is actually the warmest light. Where if you don't compensate and you're shooting into the shade, it's going to be super, super blue. So you have to...
The shade is the warmest... What?
Yes, it's the highest on the Kelvin scale. It's about 7,000.
The shade?
Mm-hmm.
What? I'm not understanding.
So let me pull it up right here. So here's an image of the Kelvin scale. Let me zoom this in a little bit. So you can see...
Wait, blue is on the top of the Kelvin scale?
It makes sense though, right? You know, the hottest suns are blue, and the biggest and like technically coldest suns are big red giants. Even though the biggest, yeah, they're actually give off the least amount of heat. We don't need to go into that. This is a film podcast. But anyways, so right now we're looking at, this is kind of was going to ruin my question, but or my quiz for you. But so a flash is around 6,000, so just a little bit more. Technically, this is cooler, but it's a higher it's kind of like f-stops, where like this is a warmer, oranger light, and this is a bluer, colder light, but then this is actually hotter, so it's opposite. But so a flash is right around here, right around the middle. Mm-hmm. The problem with a flash is flashes are great if you're shooting outside, because it matches, you know, direct sunlight. Even cloudy sky, which is around 6,500, 7,000, then the shade, which can get up to 8,000. So a flash is good for those situations because the light that you're shooting at the subject is going to be balanced with the rest of the background. Because a flash only works for the subject. A flash is literally for brightening up your subject so that it balances with the background. The reason I don't use flashes is because most flashes have that light. It's also the brightest light. You can do a quick flash of that, it's going to be the brightest. You get warmer or colder in Kelvin, it's going to be a little darker, and you don't have flashes like that. So if you're shooting inside, if we're shooting in this situation, we use a flash. The flash would make us super white, and the background would be super or super cold on us, and then super warm in the background, if that makes sense. So that's the interesting thing to think about with flash is, you know, it's the balance. It messes up the balance.
Mm-hmm.
I have just a project open here real quick. I was just going to show... Normally, I would show this in Photoshop, but Photoshop doesn't have a color wheel. So I'm going to show it on here just to show kind of the spectrum. So remember we were talking about, we were looking at the white balance sheet. So Blue is the, this is colder, warmer, and then these are the artificial things that get invited in. So if I start pulling this, oh, hold on. Yeah, so starts getting super orange, obviously. Super cool. So if this was an imbalanced shot, which I guess I should have used an imbalanced shot, but, you know, this would essentially fix it. So you're pulling away from the color. So if this shot was super blue, like, let's say that I had the wrong daylight settings on. Let's say I had it on tungsten when I was shooting outside. I had it on a super warm setting, but then I was shooting outside and, you know, very, very bright. It was blue, and it came back like this, blue. Then I would start pulling towards the orange to get rid of it. So that's kind of where white balance comes in, where you're basically setting where the neutral white is, or gray. And so that's the theory of white balance. And you have different presets. We'll talk about some of the presets. You have daylight, which is around 5600. You have shaded, which is could be around 7000. You have flash, which is like 6000, like we said. Fluorescent, which is going to have some of that green cast in there, that's around 4000, so it's kind of in between the two. Tungsten, which is 3200, and then cloudy is 6000. So the presets are good, but if you kind of know this spectrum, if you kind of know what this is supposed to look like, you can set the preset and say, I'm shooting outside, but it's kind of sunny, or it's kind of getting, you know, a little bit towards the afternoon where the sun's going down, it's getting a little bit oranger, but it's not quite, you know, sunset yet. So maybe I might, instead of going for 5600 where the sun's straight up in the air, or, you know, 3400 when the sun's setting, you go in between, you use 4200. So that's how you, if you kind of know this spectrum, you can kind of cuss. I always, when I set my white balance, I'm always using Kelvin. I never use the presets. I kind of just adjust it how I want, and I leave it until the sun changes, or until a cloud covers the sun, or whatever.
That's hardcore, dude.
That's how you get it right. But one interesting thing about, because this is mostly for photography, this, all these different settings, because usually you're going to be using the same lights for all your different, in film. But for photos, it doesn't really matter, because you shoot RAW. RAW doesn't save the white balance data. So, I mean, unless you want to keep the JPEGs and use the JPEGs and upload them to Facebook real quick or whatever, it honestly doesn't matter that much. Food for thought. You learn anything?
Yeah, I learned that shade is hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, like I said, it's all about getting the white to be in here. And maybe you don't want that. Maybe you want a warmer situation, or maybe you want a cooler. So that's going to be your artistic choice. But in terms of getting the base, you usually want to have white there. So then you can warm it up or cool it or make it green or whatever in post. But that way you at least have the base level, so you can go any direction you want with it at that point.
Could you destroy your shot if you don't have the proper white balance, like, will not be recoverable
for video, but not for video and some on some cameras, yes. For photos, no, because you shoot RAW, like I said, doesn't matter. White balance doesn't actually get saved for RAW.
Well, what if you're just working off the JPEG, you're not using RAW?
Well, everybody should use RAW. I mean, plain and simple, like, if you're not shooting RAW, then, I mean, yeah, you will destroy your JPEG if you're too lazy to edit the RAWs and that's all you're going to use is the JPEGs, then yes, but yeah. Mm. All right, so you're going to talk about spindle.
Glass spindle.
And go.
Okay, so basically this is a new, well, I don't know how new it is. I think they've been working on it for about 10 years now, but it's been in development by the Navy. And it's this type of glass. It's called spindle. It's made from powdered clay, according to the source I was looking at. But essentially, it's like a glass made out of like a mineral. You know, I guess kind of like, you know, I have sapphire displays and stuff like that. But this one is supposed to be very strong and rugged.
Well, so I'm getting my Apple Watch any day now. Who knows? I freaking pre-ordered it and it still hasn't come. Ridiculous. pre-ordered it, you know, within minutes of when it came out. Mm-hmm. So everybody's been talking about the Sapphire display and how it's the second closest thing, or it's the closest thing to Diamond, to just straight up having Diamond layer display, Sapphire. So you're saying that this is stronger than Sapphire? Because what I'm hearing is that Sapphire is the closest thing to Diamond, which is the strongest known element.
Well,
unless you watch the Avengers, where they have crazy freaking made-up elements that the shield's made out of and stuff.
Part of the problem is, like, the information on this is kind of scarce at the moment, it seems like. So it doesn't have any real data on, like, you know, how much impact it can take and how weatherable it is.
Is this a natural element, or is this something they combine? I'm looking right now, it says magnesium, aluminum squared, and oxygen.
Oh, I don't know if that's what you're looking at is actually what it is.
I forgot chemistry, whatever.
But, I mean, from what they're saying, it's supposed to be better than what we have right now. Like, they want to use it on, like, their UAVs and stuff like that to replace the lenses, so it's a lot more durable. I'm not sure about, like, the optics and how good it would be, like, if it's feasible to utilize it for, like, a camera lens. I don't know.
Like
how...
a GoPro?
Yeah.
GoPro.
Yeah.
GoPro Hero 7.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, a GoPro, I think it would be good for a GoPro. But
really? Mm-hmm. But GoPros already have a case.
Oh, yeah, but
are you
I mean,
saying it's going to be sharper? Like, I mean, why is it going to just be more rugged?
Yeah.
I feel like, huh.
The durability is supposed to be way better.
Because the thing about Sapphire is that, yes, it's very, like, there's crazy videos out there of people trying to scratch their iWatches, and, like, basically, unless they take some super hardcore, like, the most hardcore sandpaper and just go at it, there's no way to scratch it up with keys or any, like, knives or whatever. But it isn't shatterproof. Like, any kind of hammer or anything will shatter the entire thing. So is this like a shatterproof thing, or is this also just like a scratch resistant thing?
Well, the interesting thing about it is they said due to the way it's made through a process that's almost kind of like 3D printing. It doesn't actually ever crack like regular glass. It'll only chip.
Huh. But then it kind of ruins the rest of it. So I mean, you only make glass once, right? You can't like half of it chip and then kind of fix it, you know? You can't sand it off and make it thinner, like metal, like stainless steel, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it can't really be repaired, but, I mean, from what they're saying, it seems like it's a much better glass material. I don't know how expensive it is to create. I mean, hopefully it's going to be relatively cheap. But I think, at the very least, it'll be, like, another option for, you know, smartphones, like you said, GoPro. Mm-hmm. Like, a really nice premium option to have, like, an extremely rugged, you know, type thing.
It says it's not like a new, it's long been found in gemstone bearing gravel and stuff like that. So it's like not a new material.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know if it's actually spinel. Like they call it spinel, but I don't know if it's actually made from spinel. Like it's made through some process. Like the thing I was reading, it said it was powdered clay. Like,
That seems really weird.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. I was on the wrong thing. It's still made out of the same material, magnesium, aluminum, whatever, too, and O4.
Well, anyways, the military, excuse me, is saying that they're going to try and propagate the technology.
Oh, yeah, so. Like we have the budget for that. Let's be honest. Come on. Just saying. So how does this compare to, like, Apple's Gorilla Glass, which is basically what they're using for the sport version of their... And all their displays have this for iPads and phones and everything.
I mean, they didn't give any like hard data on it, so I don't know how it compares to something like Gorilla Glass.
Probably better than Gorilla Glass. Yeah, they're making a big deal about it.
Yeah, exactly.
But maybe not as good as Sapphire.
Yeah.
Except for Sapphire shatters, so I guess that would be negated. It would make more sense for the military not to have things to shatter and just like crack, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it can function as bulletproof, but I'm not.
I'm just not convinced on the film use of this, though.
Yeah, I don't think it would really be that.
I think filmmakers want to have like the best quality glass to see through versus like, oh, I drop my lens all the time. Now for camera, like for camera phones, then yes, people drop their camera phones all the time. And the first thing that breaks is the freaking lens. Mm-hmm. So it'd be nice to have like a more rugged camera phone.
Yeah, yeah. Like I was saying earlier, like I feel like it would be more applicable to somebody who actually wants a rugged lens as opposed to like, you know, a quality lens.
Right.
But cool. That. Yeah.
All right. So you ready to play some? Do you even film, bro?
Totally.
All right. You're Were you 9 for 11? 9-11? Gotta get off that number.
I will never forget.
Oh, you forgot.
Hey, I had my head earlier.
Okay, so, got some questions. Call sheet. We need some, we need to up our game with some like music where I play like the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire music. Mm-hmm. Call sheet. Definition. What a potential cast member receives when trying out for a part. True or false?
False.
What is a call sheet?
I don't like a. I feel like it's like it'll have like a list of something, like maybe cast members or like equipment you need or something like that. That's
close on the last part, but no, it's not when somebody's cast. It's everybody's already. It's a for the. The day, it's a shoot list for the day. It's like what you need to bring, what you need if you're an actor or if you're on set and you're working behind the scenes, what you need to bring, what you need to be ready for, what your times are, what scenes will be shot and where, what location, how early do you need to be for makeup, and all that stuff is on a call sheet, which is given out daily, essentially. Usually by the producer or some level of producer. Okay, good job. 1 for 1. Camp. Which refers to, like, a comedic parody or, like, cliched overuse.
Yeah.
We know what camp is. Okay, no, you're right. No. But there's multiple choices. I have three movies.
Oh, no.
Cabin in the Woods, Scream, or Scary Movie.
Oh, or what?
Or all of the above.
Yeah, all of the above. I was about to say, aren't those all camp, dude? That is so not...
The trick one was Scream. What makes you think Scream was campy?
Well, because the... I don't know.
This might... I mean, this isn't technically a trick or hard question, but it is... The other ones are obviously campy versus Scream, which most people would not assume if they've seen it, unless they know certain things. So what made Scream campy for you?
Part of the problem is I don't think I really saw that movie.
Well, how do you know it's campy?
Because, I don't know, the guy with the mask just looks ridiculous to me.
Okay, so Scream was definitely campy. Scary Movie was over-the-top campy based on the Scream movies, but Scream was the first, to my knowledge, movie that basically took all the elements of popular horror films and just... like, you know, attack them, and like, you know, the super macho guy, and like, oh, let's split up, and like, all that stuff happened in Scream. So that was the first movie to like really make fun of, bring it all together and make fun of it. So yeah, good job. Okay, CGI stands for computer generated imagery, computer graphic imagery, or computer generated illusions.
I'm going to go with computer-generated imagery.
Oh, good job. 3 for 3.
Yes.
That one, I don't know. That one was a little easy, but I was trying. I was trying to like make up. I was like, oh, CGI, I can make up a bunch of acronyms for that. And I was like, oh, wait, no, I can't. But like CGI, I remember always like forgetting what it actually means. But when you have it on paper, it's kind of easy. Cinema Verite. Very popular in film school for me. Very impactful moment in my life as a film student. Documentary based filmmaking from the French New Wave movement, which uses A-list actors for political purposes. True or false? Cinema Verite.
True.
False.
Gosh, dang it.
It is documentary-based filmmaking from the French New Wave movement, which is one of my favorite times in cinema.
But it is
exactly the opposite of using A-list actors for political purposes. It does not use A-list actors. In fact, it doesn't even use actors at all. Usually, it's just someone in their life. It's a documentary, so it's usually someone. There's no acting. It was basically the dawn of documentary films, essentially. So what we see in documentary films now is like, of course, when you see a documentary film, there's no actors. But unless there's actors doing voiceover, or there's actors thrown in, or there's actors doing the questions or whatever. But this was a super fly on the wall. One of my biggest examples of cinema verite for me would be, what's the film about where they went and interviewed? It was a super emotional 9-hour documentary where the guy went and like interviewed all survivors of the Holocaust.
Borat?
Dude. What is that movie? I forget what it is. It's a super emotional movie. If you haven't seen it, I have to look it up just so I can recommend it to people. The guy like really got like really deep in, like, you know, this was like in the 70s, and he was asking super, you know, sad questions. And like there's this part where the guy was talking about how he was Polish and all of his Polish friends, he had to shave their hair, you know, before they went and basically got killed. And he knew that they were sending them to the gas chamber, but he wasn't Jewish. He was Polish, and he was his neighbors and his people who came, and like he was a barber. And he was shaving their heads and basically cheering them up and like making them feel like, oh, it'll be fine, whatever, when he knew that was the last time he was seeing them. And like that interview is like one of the most emotional, real feeling interviews I've ever seen in a documentary. So,
you know, I knew the last part of that sounded weird because verite reminded me of veritas, which is like truth in my mind.
Shoah is the name of the film. So here you go.
Oh.
9 hour. But go ahead. You were saying verite about veritas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I figured it was about the truth. So documentary, I was like, okay, yeah. And then that last part, I was like, you tricky.
So I got you on one. I had to get you on one. I definitely tried to make these harder because I feel like the past couple of times have not been hard. Composition. I'm going to name off 6 things. Tell me which one of them does not fit. Or if all of them fit. Lighting, movement, figures, dialogue, lines, colors. 7, all of the above.
All of the above?
No.
Gosh dang it. Was it dialogue or lines? That isn't
part. It was dialogue. Of the position? Okay. What do you think lines means?
I don't know. That's what I was like.
But think about it. It's not obvious. It's not the same thing as dialogue. So yeah. What do you think the lines means?
Yeah, because I was like, okay, dialogue didn't seem like it was part of the composition to me, right?
That's why I put it,
like,
right. I put it right next to lines. Yeah, because I was like, I was trying to throw you off because lines. Most people don't know about lines in film.
Is it like the how you divide the screen in thirds and stuff like that?
That's part of it.
And where people are on the.
Sometimes the composition. I'll bring up some examples. I gotta do composition lines.
Composition lines in film. Gotta Google that.
Okay, see if there's some just Google images of it. So I mean, like, just something as simple as this. So obviously you have your thirds.
Yeah.
Right, which we talked about, or this is a very popular one for putting that. You know, for the most eye, right on the where the two lines meet. Let me see more. So here's a good example. It's like what kind of emotion this can kind of convey. This is a very, like, if you've ever taken an art history class, which I don't think you have. Am I wrong? So art history, you look at a picture and one of the first thing you look at is the lines. Like, these strokes go this way and this stroke goes this way. Are they clashing? Like, what does this mean? It's a very subjective thing. But it's used not so much in today's film, honestly, but when the camera was kind of locked down, the camera didn't move around as much. Crazy lines were very important because you couldn't really get as much interest out of a shot because the camera didn't move as much.
Well, that's cool.
I'm trying to look for examples. I know Psycho has some good ones. But yeah, so obviously dialogue is the one that does not fit because it has nothing to do with composition. That's more blocking. Which we talked about last time.
Yeah, you tricky. You were too tricky for
me. Okay, so here's a good example.
What kind of lines is that?
You can't go silent on the people listening on the podcast. But yeah, we're just looking at pictures of...
There's like somebody in somebody's arms and they just randomly drew 2 lines across it. Like... No, I'm serious. It doesn't follow, like, it's not the thirds of the screen or anything. It was just 2 random lines.
It doesn't always have something to do with thirds of the screen.
Oh, are you talking about like line to like action maybe, or like the people, how in that case,
or like bodies? If you have cabinets here but then like there's a knife being held this way, and then that would be a clashing thing, you know.
Okay.
It's very, very not hippie, subjective or hipster or whatever, but it's like it's an artistic way of viewing each shot, which isn't very common in today's movies.
Dude, like, look, we got this line of the laptop.
We have the lines there, and then we have these are lined up, and yes.
Oh, wow.
That was all given thought. Wow, and then we got all this shit on the table, including all of our props, which, can we even see these? Oh, yeah, you can't see mine. Can't see mine. My RX100, which was dropped the other day. So sad. All right, so let's see how much time we got. We got a bit more time. Only at 59 minutes. So you got 3 of 5 that time. So you're now at an all-time record of 12 and 16.
That was not nice. I don't know about those questions.
But I had to make them harder. Come on, there's no reason. You're supposed to be the newbie. You can't have a 9 and 11 record. You got to have a 12 and 16. That seems more reasonable.
Okay.
We're closer now. I give you some easy ones like CGI and call sheet.
Yeah.
And camp.
Yeah, I don't think call sheet was that easy.
The camp one, I should have thrown one in there that really wasn't a camp movie. But I thought Scream would throw you, because I figured you hadn't seen Scream, but you totally just guessed, I guess.
Scream, I don't know. It just always seemed like, I know what you did last summer.
That wasn't Scream.
Oh, what is that?
That was, I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Well, whatever, same difference. I don't know, the mask just looked goofy to me, man. Like,
no, it was more about, like, how they always split up, and then there's always the jock guy, who, you know, and then there's the final girl, the very obvious, like, virgin final girl, who, like, always survives, and everybody else dies, and, like, just very stereotypical. And, like, even, there's, like, one character in it who was kind of the, guys, this is exactly what happens in a scary movie. We all just should stay together. Don't go check that sound in the garage. And, like, that guy was kind of the theme throughout all three of the scary movies. Even in the third one, when he was already dead, in the second one, he left behind a tape. So, guys, you're now in a trilogy. All the rules have changed. So that was Scream. That was, like, the first movies to do that. Mm. And one of my favorite horror franchises of all time. Until they made Scream 4 and whatever and ruined it, but...
So, wait, what exactly makes a film camp, then?
It has to blatantly point out or play upon common tropes from that genre. It's a very genre-specific thing.
Okay, so would you consider, like, Starship Troopers
to be... Oh, 100%! 100%! And that movie was so... Sometimes movies are so campy, and they know they're so campy, that they're great. There's some movies that are just straight-up unintended camp. Starship Troopers, like, with the freaking, especially with the infomercials, like, oh, gung-ho, and, like, it spins forever. I need to watch that movie again. It's been forever. But, yeah. I mean, just make the military aspect of it and just really poking fun of, it was just totally making fun of all those types of movies.
Okay. That's kind of interesting, because it was based off of a book, wasn't it?
I'm sure, but the movie was definitely not based off that book. And I mean the camp part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the way the acting was, and they had all, like, they used all the freaking actors from soap operas and stuff. And, like, I remember that was probably one of the first, I would say Alien was the first rated R movie I saw. That was the second. And that was way worse than Alien. I saw that with my uncle, and my mom was pissed after I saw Starship Troopers.
That shower scene, right?
No, not even. I remember when it first came out, my parents were watching it on DVD or VHS or whatever. I remember I would, like, go out in the living room. I was, like, 7 years old or whatever, and I remember the only part that they let me see was where they put the guy put his hand up against the wall, and the guy threw the knife at it, and, like, that image honestly was seared into my brain for 5 years. Like, that destroyed me.
Wow.
I might have been, like, 6. I don't even know. It came out in, like, 97, so I was, like, about 7, I guess. I don't know. Anyways. So that's what camp is. So that's Cabin in the Woods. Did you see that, Cabin in the Woods?
No, but I want to, because I always heard it's really good.
Okay. Yeah. That's a... Yeah, we need to watch that. That's a... That takes camp to a whole new level. But the thing is about camp is like, I've seen that movie probably twice, and I've seen it with a group of people, and then I saw it with my dad, and I feel like 90% of the time it goes over people's heads who don't really know the intricacies of like the meta aspects of film and then the meta aspects of the genre specifically. And that movie, it gets so blatant at the end, but as you're watching it, you're kind of like, oh, this is stupid. Well, no, it's actually literally making fun of this movie, but it's not like Scary Movie, where Scary Movie is obviously funny to people because they could see, oh, they're making fun of I Know What You Did Last Summer. Oh, they're making fun of Scream because it's the same villain. Like, yeah. It's very, like, almost like we talked about, you know, freaking Paul Blart and, like, Adam Sandler movies, where it's very slapstick, in your face, like, 1 in 4 Americans are retarded, so we'll make it simple for you. Whereas Cabin in the Woods is very, like, highbrow, I feel like, meta cinema, where you have to know the stuff to get it. So, that's why I like that movie.
Of course you would, you highbrow, high-level cinema.
Yep, wearing my jersey. Basketball jersey. All right, well, I think that's it for this week. Be back next time. We learned about white balance. Learned about those new lenses coming out, that sexy 85. The competition to the 5DS, the A7R II,
most likely. I think it's another camera.
Yeah, we'll conclude on that next time. Talked about that that glass.
Spinal, whatever.
Spinal, transparent glass, whatever. And the Avengers that came out. I think you should see it. I think it's worth seeing. You should just go see it so you can be part of the $150 million that it made.
No.
So you can be like, yeah, so I went to go see the Avengers, and when it made $195 million in one weekend, it got $12.50 of my dollars. All right. Signing off. See you guys next week. Actually, download on iTunes, people. Please, Film in 5D. Search for us.
Yes.
Download on iTunes. Leave a comment. Subscribe. Rate. 5 stars, ratings only. And if you're not subscribed on YouTube, subscribe on YouTube. I'm going to come out with a video next week. I might do a trailer, but I'm going to do a video about what my shortcut settings and my function settings are for my A7S. I did kind of a video of overall right when it came out, you know, the menu, and that video was kind of popular. So I figured here's my settings, and just, that way you can just set it to mine and see how you like it. So I'll be doing that next week. And I'm going to record it with the Shogun, so I'm not just recording the screen and me pushing buttons. It's actually going to be full screen up in there, me clicking through the menu. So that's going to be cool.
Nice.
All right. See you next week.
Bye-bye.